welcome to the Hyphen Church Podcast, where faith meets the spaces in between. We're here to explore what it means to belong, to grow, and to encounter God in the midst of life's questions and complexities. Whether you're here to listen, reflect, or take a step forward, know that you're in the right place. Let's make space together for what God is doing in us and through us. Now, let's dive into today's message.
So we've entered into the new year, and if you didn't know that, you probably slept through it. You know, that was what happened in our house. But we're working at a better pace now. We want to take the beginning of this year, and we want to slow down. This is still the 11th day of Christmas, by the way. Christmas doesn't officially end until tomorrow. So if you're still celebrating, if your tree is still up, don't worry. There's no pressure to take it down yet, because Christmas isn't officially over until tomorrow. All right, so you're okay. And then that starts Epiphany on January 6th. But we want to start in this new way of living, this better pace that we want to set ourselves up into. And many of us are exhausted. And we're not exhausted because we're doing bad things or the wrong things. And we're exhausted, if we're honest, because we're trying to keep up. We're trying to be enough for other people. We're trying to hold it all together. We're trying to tread water and keep our heads afloat. And even our faith at times feels a little bit too heavy. It feels like faith is just another thing that I've got to hold on to. It's not keeping me afloat, it's weighing me down. It's making me feel burdened. And most of us aren't rebelling against God, we're just worn out. And after we come out of Advent and after we come out of Christmas, we really feel that pace. We really feel like, man, what did I just go through? It seems like we hurry up and hurry up and hurry up, and then all of a sudden it's just over and we move on to the next thing. This is not a series about productivity. This is not a series about doing less for the sake of our comfort, so that we can feel better about ourselves. This is about learning a different way of living. How to live better with Christ, how to live better with each other. Before Jesus ever talks about how to live, though, he issues this invitation to us. And to understand that invitation, we first have to work through what's wrong with us. What's wrong with our generation? What's wrong with our society? What's wrong with our churches and our Christians and how we believe and how we move through the world? And so we're going to look at a passage in Matthew, which is what Jesus is teaching his disciples, really critiquing them first. And this is from Matthew 11. We're going to read verses 16 through 19, and then we're going to jump to verses 25 through 30. Jesus says this, "But to what will I compare this generation? It's like children sitting in marketplaces and calling to one another. We played the flute for you, and you did not dance. We wailed, and you did not mourn. For John came neither eating nor drinking, and they said, 'He has a demon.' And the Son of Man came eating and drinking, and they said, 'Look, a glutton and a drunkard, a friend of tax collectors and sinners.' Yet wisdom is vindicated by her deeds." Verse 25. "At that time Jesus said, 'I thank you, Father, Lord of heaven and earth, because you have hidden these things from the wise and the intelligent and have revealed them to infants. Yes, Father, for such was your gracious will. All things have been handed over to me by my Father, and no one knows the Son except the Father, and no one knows the Father except the Son, and anyone whom the Son chooses to reveal him. Come to me, all who are weary and are carrying heavy burdens, and I will give you rest. Take my yoke upon you and learn from me, for I am gentle and humble in heart, and you will find rest for your souls. For my yoke is easy and my burden is light." Will you pray with me? Father in heaven, as we have heard your words, as you have revealed them, Help them enter from our ears to our hearts. Help take what we have heard and illuminated in our hearts to move us forward, that we can see what it is that you see. We can know what you know. We ask this in your Son's name. Amen. You did not dance. You sat in the marketplace and we called to you and we played the flute and you did not dance. Jesus is looking at a generation sitting in the marketplace and not dancing. He's looking at a generation sitting there in public with other people, with other children gathered around, and they say, we want to play, but we don't want to play in your way. Jesus doesn't begin with rest, does he? He begins with this diagnosis of the generation. Why does he start with this critique? Why doesn't he start with the invitation? Why does he have to show us how we are? Why does he have to know our souls so well? What must be named and dismantled before rest can be received? What is it that is working against us in our own lives that Jesus is coming to point out to say, excuse me, but I see this is happening in your life? And until we can name it, until we can push it to the side, until we can restore those things, we can't enter into rest. Jesus is talking about this generational weariness. He's talking about this thing, maybe boredom that we feel, maybe tiredness, maybe heaviness, maybe lack of courage. This generation is like children sitting in the marketplaces. The image would have been immediately recognizable and unsettling to his audience. Marketplaces were the center of public life, where commerce and news and social judgment happen. And Jesus is picturing children sitting there, calling out to other children, expecting them to respond to their games. We played a flute for you, but you did not dance. We sang a dirge and you did not mourn. And the audience would have felt that conflict. They would have felt that weariness, that impossible to please attitude, that obstinance, that obnoxiousness that goes with it, the emotional manipulation. There are pressures that are shaping this generation. There are pressures that are shaping our generation. And they're not just individual pressures, but they are community pressures. And Jesus isn't critiquing the children. He's diagnosing. He's pointing out something that's happening. And he's using the children as an example to say, you feel it too, don't you? You feel the way that other people are acting and you're not responding to it. And so the critique has these several layers, this restlessness without direction. People are really impossible to satisfy. John comes with his severity. It's too extreme. And Jesus comes with his gentleness. It's too indulgent. It's too relaxed. And the problem isn't the method. It's the underlying refusal to respond to it. It's not exactly the way we want it to be, so therefore we're not going to indulge in it. John's too tough on us, Jesus is too weak on us, and we don't have anyone who can satisfy our needs the way we want to. But there's conflicting expectations. The generation is being pulled in opposite directions. There's religious pressure that says, be better. And there's cultural pressure that says, do more. And there's comparison pressure that says, keep up with everyone around you. This really creates pressure without peace. And Jesus says, you can feel that, can't you? You can feel what's going on in the world. The idea of be better and do more and keep up. And you've held that into your souls. There is a spiritual immaturity that's disguised as discernment. They're rejecting both John and Jesus, not because either is wrong, but because they want to be in control. They want to set the terms. They not receive what has been offered to them. And the image is devastating because it shows a generation that has become emotionally unreachable. Does that sound familiar or what? Oh, kids these days. Oh, this generation is toast. Jesus saw it too, by the way. You're not the first one to discover that the next generation is doomed because they're not doing things the way that we want them to do things. It's not because they're evil. It's not because they're exhausted and defensive. It's sitting in the marketplace waiting for someone to play by their rules. I'd love to play your game, but it has to look the way that I want it to look. Jesus describes people who are impossible to satisfy. Do you know those people? John comes fasting and it's too extreme, and Jesus comes feasting and it's too indulgent. And the problem isn't the method, it's the restlessness that Jesus is speaking to underneath it. But why does pressure make us restless instead of faithful? Why does pressure make us feel this restlessness, this I don't know how to be satisfied in it. I don't know how to sit with this tension. I'm reading into the wrong tension. And burnout isn't always caused by doing too much. Sometimes it's caused by trying to live under conflicting expectations. It's about a culture that can't settle. And so pressure doesn't come only from outside. It comes with living under competing voices inside us, a competing consciousness, religious expectations, cultural hustle, social comparison, internal shame. And so pressure demands performance, but faith requires trust. So when we're under pressure, we shift into a mode where we're trying to earn something, or we're trying to focus on outcomes we can control. We're measuring ourselves against external standards. And this is fundamentally incompatible with faith, which requires receiving rather than earning, or trusting what we can't control, resting in someone else's sufficiency. And so pressure always creates this state of perpetual inadequacy. No matter what you do, there's always more to prove, or there's always higher standards to meet, or there's always someone else doing it better. You can work your entire life to reach a plateau. You can say, here's my goal in life, here's my goal in life, and that's someone else's starting point. But you always have to remember that your starting point is also someone else's goal. There's always going to be someone who can do it better. And we feel restlessness because there's this gap between where you are and where you should be. And so here's what I think restlessness is. Restlessness is what happens when you're trying to close a gap that can never be closed by your own effort. When you're pulled in opposite directions simultaneously, be better and do more and keep up, you can never arrive, but you can never close that gap through your own effort. And Jesus is diagnosing a generation who believes that their own effort is the solution. They believe that sitting in the marketplace and not playing games is the only solution for us, because this is how I can solve the problem with my own effort. If I can control the game, if I can control all the rules and can control the way that these things are happening, otherwise I'm not going to play it. You're always in motion. You're always inadequate. You're always searching for the right move. And Jesus is saying, this is what you're feeling. You're feeling a restlessness that that comes from trying to solve everything with your own effort. But there is an alternative, Jesus says. There is an alternative, a faithfulness. Now, what would that look like under pressure? It would require us to do something radically different. Accepting that you can't satisfy everyone. You knew that though, right? You knew that you can't make everyone happy. We try all the time to do it, but we cannot do it. And we take that personally. We take that as a challenge to us and who we are. It would require us to distinguish between God's actual assignment and the pressure we have internalized. Faithfulness would require us trusting that our worth isn't determined by our performance. Ooh, there's a heavy one, right? That if society is calling me to do better and be more and keep up, maybe God is asking the same thing on my life. Maybe that restlessness I feel is because God is asking me not to carry those things. And I've started to carry some things that God hasn't asked me to. See, I think that faithfulness would mean setting down burdens that aren't ours. And that feels terrifying when you've been taught that your value depends on your ability to carry them. Your worth in Jesus' eyes is your ability to do a Bible study weekly or daily. The strength of your prayers. The reach of your love. God says, you carry those, okay? You do better in that. And then I'll accept you. We keep changing our tune because we're trying to survive between too much and not enough. And so spiritually, we start to ask the question, am I doing enough? But Jesus never asks us to carry the pressure to prove our worth, the fear of falling behind, the burden of managing everyone's expectations, the responsibility of saving ourselves. What am I carrying that Jesus never asked me to carry? Why do capable, sincere people miss rest while others seem to find it? Why is it that I'm holding on to all of this when other people don't seem to be doing that? Jesus thanks God. Verses 25 through 27, he thanks God that truth is hidden from the wise and learned, and it's revealed to the little ones. But why is that? Why is rest hidden from the wise and learned? Wise and learned people have a confidence in mastery. They have confidence in their self. They're self-sufficient. And it's not hidden from them because Jesus says, oh, hide it from these people. It's hidden on their own accord. They've decided that the things worthwhile in life are mastery, are self-sufficiency, are more knowledge, are more control. That's why rest is hidden from them. And if you're experiencing those things, if you're trying to control and you're trying to do things by your own effort, rest is going to be hidden from you. It wasn't because Jesus made a choice to hide it from you. It's because you made a choice to focus on the things that Jesus says are not important. Little ones, infants, babies, children, those people are open, they're dependent, they're receptive. They have to receive the things given to them. And just like that baby who is done at her mother's chest, we say they can rest now because they have everything they need. My Father has it. Everything I need, my Father has it. We sang that this morning. This is not about intelligence. This is about posture. And it's not anti-intellectual. It is anti-self-sufficiency. Jesus isn't saying you don't find rest. You don't receive rest. You don't find rest by mastering the system. You receive rest by trusting the Son. Rest is not unlocked by those willing to be taught. those who admit limits, those who come empty-handed. It's received through relationship. Before Jesus offers rest, he offers himself. So the heart of this passage are verses 28 through 30. The invitation, come to me. Jesus locates rest in responsibility. Isn't that an interesting thing? It's not read the scriptures more and you'll have rest. It is come to me and you'll find rest. It's not instruction. It's not obedience. It's come and have a relationship with me. He doesn't say, come and figure this out. Come and get your life together. Come once you're less tired. He says, come to me. Come to me. And there are three active verbs in that. The first one is come. Proximity produces productivity. It's not a program, it's a person. Come to me. Take my yoke. This is shared weight. It's not solo responsibility. It's saying, take it upon yourself to be with another person, to be communal in your work. Why does Jesus pair rest with a yoke instead of removing responsibility altogether? Isn't it interesting that he says rest is still taking something upon you? It's not walking away completely. So then we have to ask the question, what kind of work brings peace rather than exhaustion? And then he says, learn from me. This is formation. It's not performance. It's not coming to Jesus and saying, I have already done all of these things that you've called me to. It is, let me sit in your presence and learn from you. How can I move and be formed by you? The yoke isn't no responsibility. It's not anti-responsibility. It's something worth carrying. That's the kind of work that brings rest. It's shared responsibility. It's life carried with Jesus. And so the yoke isn't freedom from work. It's shared work. When two oxen are yoked together, they carry the load together. They move at the same pace. They are bound in the same direction. And so Jesus is saying, you're not going to be one oxen in the field by yourself, and it's not going to be the two of us just kind of wandering around doing something. Take this on you. Take this responsibility on you to sit at my feet, and we will be there together, working as a team in the same direction. He's saying, stop carrying it alone. Stop carrying it at your pace. Stop carrying things I never assigned. And here's what makes this so subversive to this pressure-driven life. Think about the things you've yoked yourself to. Think about the things that you have tied yourself to. Expectations, comparison, fear of falling behind, the need to prove yourself, conflicting demands. But under Jesus' yoke, you are yoked to someone who knows the terrain. Someone who carries the weight with you. Someone whose pace is sustainable. Someone whose assignments are actually doable. The difference isn't less responsibility. It's appropriate responsibility. The yoke that Jesus offers is calibrated to what you can actually carry, not what you think you should carry. Not what others demand that you carry. Not what your anxiety tells you is necessary. But Jesus says, try this on for size. I think you'll find it's very comfortable. But why doesn't he just remove it? If Jesus removed all responsibility, he'd be denying your agency in this whole thing. You're not a passive recipient of this. You're a participant in God's work. And a lot of times we forget that and we think, oh, if he could just remove all of these things. No, we're participating in the work with him. And if we remove the yoke, then we remove responsibility. We remove purpose in our lives. Work itself isn't the problem. It's misaligned work. It's not working toward the purpose of the kingdom. And if he takes the yoke away, then that leaves us vulnerable, right? That allows us to wander away, wander in a direction that we never were meant to. A life with no yoke isn't rest at all. It's just a meaningless life. This is why the invitation is so radical. Come to me, take my yoke upon you and learn from me. My yoke is easy, my burden is light. He's not saying life will be easy, right? He's saying life will make sense. You won't be alone. My weight will be appropriate and you'll move at a pace that sustains you. Restlessness comes from being yoked to the wrong thing. What changes if I stop trying to earn what Jesus is offering? Rest is not quitting life. Rest is not outnumbing us. Rest is not indulgence. Biblical rest is being aligned with Jesus' way, moving at Jesus' pace, carrying what he assigns to us. What kind of life, what kind of community forms when we accept this invitation? What pace and what posture and presence does this rest create over time? I think, first of all, individually, it does something interesting. It moves us from striving to receiving. It creates a person who moves at a sustainable pace, who carries appropriate weight, has clarity about their actual assignment, experiences presence. But the thing is that Jesus isn't calling us to transform individually. We're never meant to stay in individual transformation. We want to see what forms communally out of that process. When we all accept that invitation to better rest, something entirely different emerges than what we typically call community. Here are some things that I would see would happen in what forms us. The first one is a culture of honesty about burden. In a pressure-driven community, in a church that is striving after pressure, is yoked to the world and not to Jesus, people hide their exhaustion, right? We come in after a long week. Work's been tough. The kids have been tough. The house is a mess. I was sick all the time. I'm avoiding everyone. And then we put on a face. Glory to Jesus. Everything's good. Everything's great. That's a performance piece, right? For other people. So you don't need to perform for God. God knows how you feel. God knows you're tired. God knows you're weighed down with the burdens of this world. But that's then a performance for everyone else. But when people are yoked to Jesus instead of these performance metrics, we can finally ask each other, what are you carrying that Jesus never asked you to carry? What are you trying to earn that's already been given? What burden are you shouldering that isn't yours? A community forms where people can name their weariness without shame. To walk in and be among a community of people and say, yeah, I'm tired. And that's okay. The second thing is mutual yoke checking. I don't know if yoke checking is a word, but I made it into a word. So I didn't have anything better to say about it. When a community is aligned with Jesus' yoke, they become discerning together about what his actual assignment is and what cultural noise and religious pressure or internalized shame is trying to do to us instead. Someone says, I feel like I have to be perfect for God to love me. And we as a community of yoke checkers can say, that's not the Jesus yoke that I know. That's a burden he never assigned to you. It's catching on. I could be a yoke checker. Slowly, people learn to distinguish between conviction from Jesus and condemnation from pressure. The third thing, I think that as a community, if we accept this invitation, that a better pace becomes possible. Pressure-driven communities move at the speed of the most anxious person. Everyone's running. Everyone's gaining. Everyone's trying to figure out what the next best big thing is going to be. And can you imagine if you had a leader or a pastor who was up here saying, what's the next big thing? How can we grow? How can we do better than we did last week? There are churches in our community where the leaders of the churches believe those things. How are we going to get more? How are we going to do it better? How are we going to be bigger than everyone else? And those are performance metrics, by the way. That's bowing to the worship machine, the performance machine. But when people are yoked at Jesus' pace, something really amazing happens. The community can actually slow down together. There is time for presence among one another. There's space for people who move differently. There's permission to say no without guilt. Will you serve? No, I won't, because it's just too much for me right now. Okay, we'll ask again later. Are you sure? Are you sure? Could you please do this? The church needs you. We need you to serve. You're supposed to serve. Remember. No, that's okay. We can move at your pace. There are rhythms that sustain us rather than deplete us. And when we get into a checkmark world of church, this is just another thing I have to do. That's a burden-based faith. A community yoked to Jesus develops a better pace, one that is visible and contagious and countercultural. The fourth thing is, and this is a great shift from my understanding, that we can share strengths, not necessarily sharing burdens. This is a subtle shift. In pressure-driven communities, people share their burdens, which is a good thing, but the burden itself still remains heavy. It still weighs on the community. In a community that's yoked to Jesus, people share the yoke, which means that you're not carrying things alone, but you're also not multiplying the weight. You're moving together toward the same thing, and your strength comes from alignment, not a collective effort. This is different from we're all in this together, which can still be exhausting. It's more like we're all learning to move at Jesus's pace together. What does this mean for us? What does this mean together as a community? And finally, a posture of receiving, not just doing. Pressure-driven communities are achievement-oriented. They measure success by output. But a community accepting Jesus' invitation develops a different measure. Are we becoming more trusting? Are we learning to receive? Are we becoming less defensive? Are we moving with less anxiety? Are we able to rest without guilt? By the way, the old measure of church was, how many people do you have? How many baptisms have you done? And people really got frustrated with church, leaders in particular, saying that week after week. How many people do you have? How many people do you have? And then we started measuring what matters. Are our people becoming more trusting? Are our people learning to receive? Are they becoming better prayers? Are they becoming less defensive? Are they moving with less anxiety? These are the measurements of a true church. Are we doing that here? What are our people being formed into? We want to be a place where people can say, I want to receive rather than do. This passage is not teaching us how to rest better. It's revealing who rest comes from. Rest is not some technique to master. It's a relationship to enter.